Okay. So, as I said, I work with a news magazine called Between the Lines. It's based in Connecticut. And Between the Lines is a weekly syndicated program broadcast on more than 50 stations in the country and in some cases outside the country. It's produced all by volunteers, and the program got started during the run-up to the first Gulf War in 1991. It provides a platform for individuals and spokespersons from progressive organizations generally ignored or marginalized by the mainstream media. And Between the Lines covers a wide range of national and international political and economic and social topics. I want to, first of all, just thank my Between the Lines colleague, Scott Harris, who put in an incredible amount of work and a lot of his knowledge in how to do these things and setting up this panel with me, and to Anna Manzo, Scott's partner, who is also here, who's been helping a lot, too. So thanks to them. And just want to get started today by mentioning an interesting experience happened to me a little over a year ago in the programming that I do at WPKN. I asked a progressive economist who I was interviewing on the air to describe what a socialist solution to the current economic morass in the U.S. would look like. My guest balked, stating that such speculation was not useful given the current political realities. His point being that the political center had shifted so far to the right in this country that no one would seriously entertain a debate about the radical restructuring of American society. He certainly has a point. The current abysmal state of American political discourse and governance that dared not speak the names single-payer, working-class, card-check voting, union organizing, etc., was born in the virulent anti-communism endemic in this country, but, of course, during the McCarthy period and the Cold War, it was nurtured during the Reagan 80s and whipped up to a truly grotesque proportions under George W. Bush. And I should also add, since 2010, when it appears that a large portion of our government was kidnapped by aliens or some other life form. But in any case, the debate has suffered for all that. But that was then, a few months before Tahrir Square, Wisconsin, and Occupy Wall Street, and this is now. Republican candidates accusing each other of vulture and crony capitalism, greed and corruption, and exposing each other's craven subservience to corporate interests, and mainstream politicians, including Obama, talking about taxing the rich, union rights, and the obscene gap between the super rich and the rest of us. A year ago, no media pundit or politician acknowledged the existence of economic classes in America. But by this fall, even the most cautious among them were speaking delicately of wage earners versus dividend earners. And a serious discussion of the economic interests and demands of working people was underway. Here we go. So we're here today to consider the idea that everything is on the table, that a powerful grassroots movement is questioning the viability of capitalism, of the capitalist system at every level, from the distribution of wealth to corporate control of the political process to the failure of private health care and the financial system to environmental degradation and beyond. So are the changes demanded by Occupy Wall Street so fundamental, and is the awareness of the interdependence of the current political, economic, and environmental crises so acute and pervasive that the momentum for systemic change will be unstoppable and that the solutions will of necessity be radical? And what should those solutions look like? Can American, not to mention global, capitalism be reformed? Or is radical reconstructive surgery required? Our speakers today will lay out the dimensions of the crisis, describe the sinews of the movement, Occupy Wall Street and all its streams, and discuss the quality and quantity of the changes that we need, from reform to public-private dual economies, such as in Venezuela, to a socialist model approaching complete public ownership of the production and distribution of goods and services. So with that as a framework, the game plan is that we're going to give our panelists 10 minutes each and try to be pretty strict with that. And we'll start with Amin Hussein, who is, I'll give a short bio. And as I introduce each panelist, I will give their bios. But our panelists, as you know, are Amin Hussein, Chris Rood, Laura Gottensdiener, and Garo Perovitz. So I thank you all for coming. And we start with Amin, and I'm going to actually shift this mic down there after I do a little bio of you. Amin is an organizer with Occupy Wall Street, starting in the months preceding the occupation. He has a Juris Doctorate from Indiana University and a Master's in Law degree from Columbia University. Amin practiced corporate finance at a large law firm in New York City for 5 years before leaving law to study art at the Whitney Independent Study Program. Prior to coming to the United States, Amin lived in occupied Palestine in the territories and was active in the first Palestinian uprising. So I will pass this mic to him.
Thanks. I'm grateful to be here. I guess the best starting point for me is to kind of describe Occupy in relation to some of the things that were just mentioned. There were a few conversations that we had end of July, early August, that were really fundamental to how Occupy looks like right now and how everyone's shaping it. One of them were the notion of demands. And the conversations were intense. And it was about having demands or not having demands, and how do you start something where people can feel empowered? Because I think everyone agreed that the changes that need to happen are systemic, and also that no one really could agree on the solutions. But that was part of, I think, what we came to realize in these intense conversations by email and in our general assemblies leading up to September 17th. And the general sense that we had then is what's important is to occupy, liberate space, give it to people where they can constitute themselves as political beings, elevate the discourse about all the issues that are plaguing our nation, recognize that this movement is part of a global movement, that there's a cross-fertilization that's happening, that it is within the context of, you know, it has definitely a structural critique, and to the extent that anti-capitalism, and we've tried to stay away from using isms because they don't tend to be helpful when you have different strands of society trying to come together and build coalitions around these issues, to say that anti-capitalist is helpful to the extent that it opens up space. And the idea here was about, again, having conversations. It's not about how smart you are, but it's to take a step back and to hear other people and to build power with. And this kind of goes to the notion of, you know, I hate to mention Camus in this context, but the idea of, you know, we've tried to pursue justice for a very long time, certain revolutionary movements or certain social movements at the expense of freedom. And to the extent that freedom was relevant to the analysis, it was bourgeois freedom, right? It's a certain type of freedom. And I think what you're seeing in Occupy right now is that our freedoms are limited to a large degree, and that when it comes to dissent, that's not available. So stepping back, one of the things was demands. And we really wanted to take a radical approach to this. The idea of 1% to 99% came about by trying to figure out how to outreach to a group to join a general assembly. And the idea of general assembly is not to fetishize process, but is to have a direct way for people to engage on a horizontal level. Some of the lessons, we can get to some of the lessons that we learned in Occupy right now. One of them is that, you know, you really can't scale up general assemblies very well, that they tend to be oppressive at some point, and that people that actually are very good at process tend to oppress marginalized voices at a point when, in fact, the process was meant to empower. Notions of step up and step back and the like. You know, so that's one really heavy debate that happened. And the other heavy debate that happened had to do with leadership and hierarchy and structure. And, you know, there again, it's taking a step back and trying to figure out, look, we've been all fighting for these issues for a very long time, but we haven't been successful at them, because we have been going issue by issue, and we seem to expect a leader at some point in time, which itself may be a myth. I mean, you may have someone that's very eloquent in speaking, but I don't think, I think that, you know, really it's many people coming up, and I think the strength of Occupy in its amorphousness, and agreed that it's hard to plug into, but it's meant to create an environment for people to, you know, there is leading involved. You know, it's not leaderless, it's leaderful. You know, you step up when you have to, you step back when you have to. But a budding social movement isn't dependent on one person or two people or three people. The issues and the analysis and the solutions are much more radical. And I'll throw this in there. I mean, part of what Occupy is, in my opinion, these are just my opinions, reacting to, is this notion of the end of history. You know, we're still stuck with Francis Fukuyama. You know, communism fell. Here's capitalism. Here it's financialization at a very advanced level, and this is the best we can do. And the answer is, with Occupy, it doesn't matter that this is the best we can do. It's not good enough, right? So how can you create space for imagination to build power with each other to address these things? And I think that's where Occupy was coming from. On those two issues, you know, those are two things. I don't want to even take more time than I have to, because I would love for a conversation to come up out of this. I think my personal opinion in these conversations, and I'll share just 1 or 2 minutes, that there are many strands in this movement. What we're trying to, I'm not an organizer. This is not my training. It's not my background. It was mentioned that I was involved in the Palestinian uprising. That, you know, that was a peaceful resistance movement. You know, very different. It was still illegal what we were doing under the Israeli occupation laws. But I think one of the things that are happening right now is that we want to break down the binaries between left and right and center, independent, Republican, and Democrat. Those limit imaginations. The electoral process doesn't work, but that doesn't mean you have to abandon it. That part of what Occupy is trying to tell people is feel empowered, but a social movement will have to, it's just starting, and it'll go beyond November. And we have to be patient. And it isn't about what is Occupy doing, because Occupy is for everyone to own and to shape and to feel empowered in it. And we don't have solutions. I have a solution in my head, right? But that's not relevant, frankly, right now. And I don't want to go that route. I don't think that's what we need to be doing. And so I'm not going to do that. There's unions, there's the left, the institutional left, there's, you know, community organization, there's many people that have been working very hard, and we're having conversations with them. But there is a radicality to American politics that needs to come back. And rather than feeling marginalized, we need to empower each other to take the streets, have public dissent, not be bought and sold at elections. So that's it for now.
Well, I'd like to build on what you said and not repeat anything you said, but let's take what you said as a series of premises, and how do we go forward? And I would put it this way: how do we be faithful to the kind of a truth event which occurred at Zuccotti Park? And I think a new set of politics and practices were created there, and our task going forward is how to be faithful to them, and how to create this movement which does empower people, because I think you're absolutely right. Empowering people and building a movement is the first thing we have to do before any restructuring of our society. Given that, there is actually a mathematical theorem which I think is relevant to most things, theory of knowledge, but also it's important to politics. And its notion was done by Dedekind, and it's known as Dedekind's cut. It's actually how irrational numbers were created. And it's a theorem in mathematics is that between any two numbers, you can always find another number. In other words, you can always divide two different sets in two. You can always separate two different sets. I think going forward, what we have to do, and this is what I think is a premise of what it means to be a radical, you have to make a cut. In our way of thinking, a cut in our social fabric. You have to make some kind of division. You have to separate what is new is from old. And remember that between any two numbers, between any organization, if anything, you can always make a cut. You can always make a separation. one of our jobs we have to do is make a cut between the old and the new. In a sense, therefore, we have to kind of separate ourselves from a society of which we're embodied. The way I go into another tradition, thinking about how we're going to make that cut, has to do with a notion that Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist, talked about, and it has to do with the notion of creating a national popular collective will. For Gramsci, the vision of a new society is, first of all, cultural. We want to create a new culture. If you think about it, we want to be radical. We want to create a society where we have different holidays. Think about all the holidays which we still celebrate, which are centuries old. We want to create a society where we celebrate different holidays. One of the holidays which we want to celebrate, which is a holiday we are going to celebrate, is May Day. That's a holiday which has not been celebrated in the United States in a viable way for a long time. But we want to create a national popular collective will. We want to create a new culture. And the way do we create a new culture, as there after all, is through political and economic reform. Because it's by reform of the economy that we create new cultures, create new societies. And therefore, you can think of our politics, or our politics is a condensation of the economy. And our politics, again, is once again a creation of a new culture, of a new way of being. And culturally and politically, that means ultimately founding a new state, a new total organization of society. Going forward in this process of making this cut, of creating a national popular collective will, we're going to face a series of binary choices. And the kind of choices we have to make are going to be predetermined. We're not going to have a choice over the kind of choices we're going to have to make. But one way or another, we're going to basically have to roll up our whole movement into a series of yes or no answers to various kinds of questions. And depending upon how we answer those questions, the kind of choices we make, our movement is either going to survive empirically. Movements do die. They do die off. They are destroyed. They are destroyed by the oppositional forces. But we also have to be careful in the choices we make, we don't betray ourselves. And betraying our cause is something we also have to worry about doing. So we have to be faithful to our cause, make these binary choices. And I was just thinking of a few binary choices which we're going to have to make and we're going to be forced to make. And one of the concerns of whether or not we're anti-capitalist or not, or we're pro-capitalist, or what we're going to do about the capitalist. I was involved a few weeks ago in a forum on making the commons. And I think the notion of a commons is a very powerful and a beautiful idea. And we can think of a variety of things, three varieties of commons. One of the commons which is important is our language, our culture, our knowledge. Another commons which we share is our environment. Also, we have our genetics, our own bodies are part of our commons. And finally, we have what we have in common with one another, namely our social relationships with one another. The difficulty is that our common is torn apart, in particular torn apart socially by those people who are privileged and those who are not. And therefore, our commons is destroyed. One of the things I learned to admire out of working with this Forum of the Commons are people who kind of imagine a different kind of banking system, or the people who take inspiration from the internet and imagine that there's through the internet we can create a whole different kind of social processes. One of the things that we learned from this, and I one of the things we learned from this is that frankly we don't need bosses. We don't need the capitalist. We can do it ourselves. The difficulty is, and this is where the binary choice happens, is that the capitalists, our bosses, don't know that. They think we still need them or they still need us. and therefore, as we go forward, we're going to find resistance. And the resistance is, first of all, going to be in the form of the organized violence of the state. So we're going to have to make a binary choice about that process, one way or another. Related to that, and you alluded to that, we're going to have to make a choice about whether or not we're involved in our government as it exists. One of the things that astonished me when it suddenly occurred to me about the United States and the U.S. Constitution is that we have the oldest government in the world. All other governments have gone through a series of revolutions. Even England has gone through a series of political transformations. But we have the oldest government in the world, our republic of property. Isn't it somehow sometime that we have to invent and recreate a different kind of politics, a different kind of state? So the binary choice is there. What are we going to do about our republic? I don't want to call it a democracy, because it's never been a democracy. It's always been a republic. But that means we have to squarely face the issue of the limits of horizontalism. Can we organize a total society on the basis of direct democracy? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that's one of the kind of questions we're going to have to face. And finally, I'd like to say something about economics, and this is something I'm supposed to talk about as an economist. The one I'm going to pass out, unfortunately I don't have enough copies for everybody, but this is a document put out by our, if you can hand it out to people out there, by the Congressional Budget Office. And it's a very strange document. The Congressional Budget Office is that part of the government which does our budget forecast. They're supposed to be bipartisan and objective. And what's interesting about this document is the following. The Congressional Budget Office, when they do their budget projections, is supposed to make their budget projections, their baseline budget projections, on existing law. Existing law has all the Bush tax cuts expire after our election. And all the important political decisions we have concerning our budget have been postponed after our elections, in which the Bush tax cuts are supposed to expire according to existing law. Therefore, according to the baseline forecast of the Congressional Budget Office, our budgetary problems are largely eliminated in the future. However, if you read the Congressional Budget Office documents carefully, they don't believe their baseline forecast. And therefore, what they take seriously is their alternative budget projection, in which we have budget deficits appear and they don't go away, largely because they assume that after our election, we're going to renew the Bush tax cuts. And what this means is Greece is going to come home to us. And it's going to come home to us in a massive way after our election. And I think one of the things we're going to be forced to do.
What does that mean? Greece is going to come home to us?
It means we're going to have the kind of austerity we see in Greece, as in the United States, as we see in Greece right now. Greece has had these massive budget cuts. The whole democratic process in Greece has been abrogated. Greece has lost its sovereignty as a state, all in the interest of getting its budget in control, all in the honor of honoring its commitments to its creditors. And I think one of the things that we should do politically, and we can do politically, and some of us who have actually done work politically about this locally, is to do kind of massive resistance against the pending austerity which is going to come and will come, because we know, I assume that the Congressional Budget Office alternative budget forecast is the one which we're going to face in the future. And I should point out that there in New York City, at least, there were occupations prior to the occupation, and they had to do with Bloombergville, having to do with resistance to the pending budget cuts. And also the same kind of problem is exactly what happened in Madison. And we're this is the kind of another kind of yes-no question we're going to have to face. We're going to have to face it nearer term. Is it what are we going to do about these massive budget cuts? Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. First off, I'll say the park is buzzing with energy, so I hope everybody can stop by after this panel. So the question that you raised was, what are the dimensions of the crisis? I would say that it's clear that the dimensions of the crisis are enormous when you start to look at the gap between the lived experience of individuals in this country and what our narrative is and what our national discourse is. For example, we start talking now about wealth inequality, but as you mentioned, Chris, Greece is about to come home to us. Greece has come home to us, and Detroit is about to lose all of its financial sovereignty, and it's about to become the first major privatized bank-owned city. So what I'm going to talk about today is the need for us to create a new national narrative and a new social contract. And that, more than anything for me, as my background in journalism, is what I think Occupy Wall Street is one of the things that I think Occupy Wall Street can be really pivotal in. So I'd like to take the first few minutes to talk about the word revolution and to bring more voices into this conversation. When I was living in the park, I worked in the kitchen, as you mentioned, and I interviewed a few other people in the kitchen, or all the people in the kitchen working group, about what this movement meant to them and what the word revolution meant to them. And I wrote down this little book, and it got rained on, so I apologize if it's a little incoherent. But I'm just going to read a few, but this way we can have more people in this room. A revolution is an infinite thing for me. Right now, humanity is at a turning point where there are so many of us revolutionizing the way that we structure ourselves because we know we need to do so to survive as a species. When I think of revolution, the first thing that comes to mind is a forest fire. But it's not bad, because what's happening is inside the dead trees and shrubbery are getting burned away so that new ones can grow. Revolution means fighting for purpose, for the purpose. And lastly, revolution to me means an opening of hearts and minds and souls, an opening of the collective consciousness. So what these answers speak to me about revolution is the idea that, first and foremost, it has to be a change in the dominant ideas, perspectives, and modes of teaching as a redefinition of our nation's purpose, as an opening of new space in our collective and consciousness. As we move into spring, a lot of people are ready to roll up their sleeves and now get down to the busy work and the real business of affecting structural and systemic change. In my opinion, I would say that we're not ready for that if we can't think of a better word for describing this than getting down to business. How, for example, can we articulate demands if we haven't harnessed a language in which we're speaking about all foreclosures as illegal, not quoting the number or the percentage of illegal foreclosures? In my opinion, the power of Occupy is opening space out of which a new master narrative can emerge. I would disagree that the reform could precede the creation of this culture. And I would say that this creation culture has to precede the political reform. I think this culture and this narrative is what provides the context and the power out of which systemic change can happen. So lastly, and then I'll really jump in framing this issue, every day I think about something my mom told me when I started working with Occupy, very much against her wishes. And she said, "Laura, please be careful, because not because I was living in the park, but because people who feel powerless gravitate to powerful stories because their own stories are so disempowering." And then she went on to say, "And right now, we all feel powerless." So, new stories, new power. How do we create something that is more powerful than our current national narrative? First, I think it's worth highlighting what the dominant and master narrative is. It's a deep belief in individualism, in discrete autonomous actors competing for limited resources. To refer to the title of this panel, it's a belief in evolution, in competition between individuals as the driving force of history. and the successful exportation of competitive-based cultures and economies as the end of histories. That's not to say that I don't believe in the science of evolution, but if we don't have individuals tied together into a shared community, frankly, in a capitalist system, we become no more than walking mannequins who are still wearing our price tags to intimidate the others around us. We become a world where unions and immigrant justice groups hold two separate marches on May Day, where we can't speak to our neighbors about foreclosures, where the homeless don't sleep next to each other to stay warm and dry and safe. Out of this individualism has sprung two destructive and disempowering ideas. The first is a deeply rooted belief in property and property rights, so much so that they have supplanted humans and human rights. The second is a hierarchical view of history, with an emphasis on the white his. It's the history that I saw on the Mall of Washington, D.C. when I went down for Occupy Congress, the monuments to great white men and their wars, the idea that our species trajectory is shaped by only a few, that the rest of us, the masses, have no real role in shaping this new world. So it's not that we have to discount the individual, disempower the individual, but in my opinion, we have to root the individual in a community, a shared sense of purpose, and the collective will that Chris mentioned. This duality is why Occupy ascribes both to autonomous action, the rights of the individual, and consensus process, the building of a community that consenses on collective values and collective goals. Simply put, we have to start talking about what collective evolution could mean. One way that I think we've begun this process is the exercise of the people's mic. I know we've all seen the people's mic, and at this point, people like me, especially with backgrounds and worlds, are super frustrated because it's inefficient, and frankly, I don't know where to put the prepositions. But let's talk about the people's mic once again, because spring is coming, and I hope that it really becomes part of our actions. The people's mic turns an individual's speech into a collective speech act. And in my opinion, more than empowering the speaker, it changes the position of the listener. It turns the listener into an active vocal participant. Yes, there's plenty of studies that say that by speaking something, you actually retain the information much more than by reading it. And I think that's important. But what I think is more important too is that it turns the listener into a full speaker in and of herself. And that's a metaphor for the whole challenge. How do we build a new narrative that is not written by a few and marketed to the masses, but one that's actively built and chosen by the whole community? This is why we have no leaders and spokespeople, and I know how much it infuriates many who need a coherent articulation so that we can demand policy change now. But in my opinion, at its core, I at least am not trying to shift the narrative left. I'm trying to challenge what a narrative is, who controls it, and who consumes it. It's a question of asking if it's possible, and I don't know if it is, if we can create a narrative that is not tested, packaged, marketed, and sold, but one that is built by everyone to reflect our actual needs, lives, and desires. So, as I mentioned earlier, in my opinion, this DC monument view of history is an incorrect analysis, that we know that the integration of all people and every single action that every individual person takes, that is what a genuine people's narrative would look like, or that is a genuine understanding of history. So then the narrative, in my opinion, would be no more than the equation line that connects the data points mapping every individual and the infinite number of actions that occur. Why is this complicated mathematical equation that I could certainly not process important? Because it ties action and narrative creation. It says that it's impossible to talk about one thing and see another thing on the ground. And that, in my opinion, is the dimension of the crisis that we're currently facing. So with this understanding of how a narrative works, we can move to the question of how to build a new one. We can see that speaking without corresponding action will not actually shift the data points that constitute history. And I still don't have a better word for that word. We have to speak through our actions. We have to create a crisis of legitimacy by continuing to widen the gap between what the state and corporate-controlled narrative is saying about the American dream and between what people on the ground are actually seeing, feeling, and experiencing. Recently, I was in Detroit, and I spoke to Bertha Garrett, a 65-year-old woman who stopped her family's eviction by working with activists to organize her neighbors to block the city dumpster that was coming to trash all of her furniture and authorize the actual eviction process. She herself that day was not blocking the dumpster because she was lying down in front of the door of the office of her local bank's branch and effectively shutting down business as usual. Later, she told me, after signing the papers to buy back her house from the bank for a fraction of what her mortgage debt had been, she told me, "It was not that I didn't understand that the bank owned a piece of paper. It was that I understood that the banks didn't understand that I owned my home." For me, this is revolutionary speech because it fundamentally rejects the supremacy of property rights. For me, speaking through the people's mic in an occupied park is radical speech because it says that private spaces are oppressive by nature, that an open public square is the only true site of governance. I think time, place, and manner matters. So I don't think a Diego Rivera mural at the MoMA is revolutionary any longer. I do think that spray-painted words and posters on the walls of bank-owned buildings in Clinton Hill, I do think that's revolutionary speech. And humorous creative actions, to me, are a form of revolutionary speech as well, because as Andy of the Yes Men recently told me, they shatter everything. They make us laugh so hard that our ribs split open and we're lying on the floor realizing that we have nothing left and we have to create something new. So this spring, I would challenge us not to get down to the business of affecting policy change quite yet. Some people will, and I will support them and stand in solidarity. But I want to reiterate here that we need a core group of people in the streets who are creating this crisis of legitimacy for the dominant narrative, who are using bodies and actions as forms of revolutionary speech that together will make new data set points in history, that together will actually shape and change the narrative. Otherwise, we're just speaking words. So I want to thank you for listening to me because I think these are all really basic ideas. But as we move into spring, I think it's important to remember that as activists and writers and intellectuals, our job isn't necessarily to articulate the narrative. It's to open the physical space, create the platforms, and be part of the actions out of which the narrative is inherently built. So thank you.
Trying to find a place to start the narrative from a different perspective. And what's in my mind is there's a passage someplace in the philosophical manuscript, in Marx's philosophical manuscripts, his early writings, in which he describes, and I'm not in these words, the concept of circularity, meaning if all of us were to stand in a circle and grow together, we would, each of us, build the cultural vision that each of the other of us would reflect upon each of the other of us. We would create our humanity in a circle. And if we were egalitarian in our vision, we would create an egalitarian circular reflection of culture that would create a community. And if we were not egalitarian, and our hierarchies began to reflect on each other, we would create and nurture a psychology and culture of inequality and authoritarianism. And the vision he projected out of that of communism, or some vision of an egalitarian community, is, I think, the inspiring metavision that many people probably here share, and a metavision in the culture that's being described. The question then becomes, at which point does that become defined in a concrete way to organize the most powerful advanced political economic system in the history of the world? So there's the dimension between the vision and the need to transform culture and the opening of a new narrative, and what the hell do you want? And if you don't know what you want, ultimately, where are we going? So at some point, there needs to be, in tension with that cultural change, an answer to where are we going and how do you do it? And can you project, as the processes of democratized talk, to a 315 million population? And obviously, there are problems. Now, the answer is not to come forward with a platform, but at some point to start a very intelligent discussion of the alternatives that need to be debated. And I don't know when that occurs in the process of Occupy. And there are many other processes around the country. There's labor activism. There's a lot going on in the black community. There are many dimensions in addition to what's going on in Occupy. I think one of the elements we've discovered in our work, we do a lot of work with worker-owned companies and co-ops and community-owned enterprise, and we've been finding on the ground elements of the next vision that corresponds crudely to the value and cultural positions. So for instance, in American culture today, in a very odd form, 130 million Americans are members of some kind of co-op. It's not active in their experience, but it is latent and could be manifest. Co-ops and credit unions, credit union co-ops are the dominant form. It's out there in American reality, and we haven't found a way to bring it into action. There are various forms of worker-owned companies, some good, some bad, some being organized in new ways from underneath. There are 10 million people involved, 10,000 companies, 5 million more people than are involved in the American private sector labor movement. A crude and very difficult structure, but something in there that speaks to a different idea that might be drawn upon. We've done some work in Cleveland with groups, and many of you probably know about what the Cleveland model of development that's emerging there, which is in part based on Mondragon. Most of you probably know the Mondragon development in the Basque Country. A series of worker-owned co-ops linked together by a revolving fund and a nonprofit corporation so that the structure is communitarian and worker-owned. These worker-owned companies can't sell out and go off on their own. They're part of a collective effort to build the community. And part of the model also involves using nonprofit institutions that are heavily paid for by the public, hospitals and universities, to help purchase from these co-ops. So hospitals in that area, University Hospital and another hospital, the Cleveland Clinic, and one of the universities buy $3 billion of goods and services a year from this neighborhood of 40,000, none of which comes out of the neighborhood. So directing some of that to build the community in a structure that is also worker-owned is happening right now in Cleveland and many other cities, by the way. There are several other cities that are picking up on the model. There's an effort to move money from banks to the credit unions, symbolically moving to a structure that is least potentially democratized. There's also a need to really redemocratize the credit unions, which are wide open to be organized. Nobody goes to those meetings, and they're democratic structures. They're wide open to be organized, and there's a lot of capital there. So one of the things we've been doing with our group is looking at these models on the ground that are very American, very embedded in American culture, have themes of community and above all, democratization of the ownership of capital. The name of that book was Capital, for a reason, that the power of a capitalist system resides in who owns the capital. Well, it's critical if you just let it sink in. 1% of American society today owns more investment capital than the bottom 300 million Americans. That's where we talk about 1% of income mostly. The real action is capital. 1% owns more than the bottom 300 million. 400 people own more capital, investment capital, than the bottom 165 million Americans. The capital in capitalism is where the power is. So a model that in some way reflected democratizing ownership of capital, I would suggest, is inherent in the cultural vision. And the second piece of that, I would suggest, is a radically decentralized vision, rather than a statist vision, is also implicit in the culture. Well, those two propositions, those three, the democratization of capital, decentralization and changing it towards a community vision, if those are shared values in some very general sense, you have begun to define the structural outlines of a radically decentralized, down-home American. You can talk to it about anybody, about credit unions, co-ops, and worker-owned companies in straightforward American. Really, I mean, one of the problems of the left, allow me to, is that we talk in language that people don't want to hear, and if you talk English, you talk American, people can understand if you know what you're talking about, if you have something to say. And I think our rhetoric has covered our failure to define really accurately what we want. But those propositions, I think, are implicit in what we're talking about, and actually you can begin to build different models that reflect those very, very simple ideas in very American terms. And we've done some work on that and tried to begin to sketch it out. And that implies a discussion and a debate, and nobody's got the answer to this. It requires a dialogue, but it is an informed dialogue which also has ideas. And I think it's implicit, and partly what we're talking about is explicating the implicit. If these values are implicit, they need to be brought up and talked about. I would totally agree with the notion what you don't want to do is start a fight over policy and but you do need to start a dialogue. Mm-hmm. Those are very different things. At some point, if you don't like capitalism, you don't like socialism, what the hell do you want? And if you don't know, why in the hell should we follow you? Good question. At some point now. So my contention, and I don't think it's even controversial, is that in this process there has to be an opening for ideas debate, rather than a political fight over what we're going to talk about right now, who's got the right answer for this particular tactic. That's a different question. But where we're going, and a second piece of that is a debate about what are the paths, again, separate from simply the need to change the culture and the tactics. And I think, again, our language gets in the way, but one way of thinking about it is the traditional liberalism accepts corporate capitalism. They get the capital, and we attempt to organize around to contain it, to regulate it, to incentivize it, to tax it. That model's dropping out. That's decaying before your eyes. Traditional state socialism was a statist vision, and the way you handled it was you had revolution, whatever that meant. One of the things that's happening, and we don't know, really important to say we don't know. We don't know the extent of it, is what I sometimes call evolutionary reconstruction. And what the hell does that mean? It means that there's popping up all over the country these co-ops and worker-owned companies, and they do change the institutional ownership of capital, but they're not, quote, revolutionary in the violent sense. They're evolving. Whether that is opening space for ideas or laying groundwork for an evolutionary process, or simply suggesting a direction for some revolution, we don't know that. But they do begin to give people content that suggests a vision that might become manifest in the culture and the politics and the idea system. So another way, you mentioned, I think, Gramsci. There's another way to think about it, the language of Gramsci in terms of the hegemonic domination of the current ideology that doesn't allow you to talk about anything else. Co-ops open a door. Worker-owned companies open a door. The state-owned Bank of North Dakota opens a door. The city of San Francisco is going to set up a credit union or a bank. All this stuff says, hey, you know, there's a different way to open a door. That doesn't mean you march through the door yet. It means that you can begin to crack, not only negatively, in the Gramscian sense of challenging the dominant ideology negatively, but also positively by beginning to develop models that suggest, I use the word suggest accurately, that suggest new possibility. So I don't have any claim or desire to say what Occupy should do. I just clap and cheer and try to help from the sidelines and every now and then go down and do whatever I can in Washington. But I do think that it's some that that dialogue somehow has to be entered, and maybe it probably is entered, as to what do you do in a society of 315 million? How do you organize the most powerful system in the world? How do we debate that in a way that also doesn't get us into crazy rhetoric and dialogue? And one final point, which is takes us beyond, and I'll stop talking. I guess that must be at the end of my time. You know, I'm an economist, so I get involved in numbers. We are shortly, within the next year, that Thomas Hanna here works with us, tells me within the next year the numbers will come out just about, this economy will produce just about $200,000 for every family of four on average. Let that sink in. $200,000, that's a very rich system. It's radically maldistributed. That means you could have $50,000 for every, $100,000 for every family of four and 20-hour week already. Or $50,000 for every family of four and a 10-hour week already. The productive power of the system as it already is in its irrational form is so powerful that it opens up and ought to open up a very different vision of what is possible. Those are real numbers, including the irrationalities. So I think somehow we've got to be able to manifest that and also I think tie it in with the ecological dimensions of how we cut back. So my plea is, not a plea, but because I think it's already being done, but how do we inject more ideas without getting caught in ideologies? So.
This question is most specifically for Mr. Alperovitz. First of all, I just want to say your book, America Beyond Capitalism, I loved it. It was assigned in my, I'm an economics student at the University of Southern Maine, and in my critical thinking in economics class, we had to watch Milton Friedman's Free to Choose, read Robert A. Dahl's Preface to Economic Democracy, and then your book was offered as a more realistic alternative to Dahl, and I just want to note that it was brought back into the class curriculum by popular demand.
Hey, thank you. that's good to hear.
I was a very big fan of the pluralist commonwealth is a place I very much want to strive for, but one of the facets of the pluralist commonwealth, the ideal that you express in the book is a reduction in the work week, and that at least in part a reduction in the work week would at least result in increased civic engagement.
Could.
And when I yesterday I went down to I've always known it as Zuccotti Park, but it's Liberty Square. Liberty Square. I went down to Liberty Square, and there was a march, and I participated in the march. I didn't know it would be going on. It was just a happy coincidence. And when we got down to the front of the New York Stock Exchange, I happened to take a look around, and I noticed more people filming than participating. And that brought to mind... it was actually a happy surprise to me that you were a panelist here. The idea of that free time leading to civic engagement, and you mentioned Putnam's Bowling Alone, how civic engagement is decreasing in the United States. And to get a little economist nerdy, the concept that came to mind to me was the idea of the marginal propensity to consume in macroeconomics. If I give someone a dollar, how much of that dollar are they going to spend, and how much are they going to save? And my question to you is, with an increase in free time, I almost, you could call it the marginal propensity to engage, the marginal propensity to interact with one's community. If you were to hypothetically, or just ballpark, how much time must be given to people for them to truly begin to adequately engage civically? And how much of that time in that work week do you think overall will be devoted to civic engagement?
I think we all can speculate on that, but that is a cultural question. That is to say, people don't have to have fancy cars and buy big houses and so forth. So it inherently, how much people actually do take democracy seriously is how much we build that culture. But it also depends, and let me suggest this another piece of that element of that book. It also depends upon a realistic structural basis for liberty. Let me say what I mean. If you're scared you're going to lose your job, even if you've got enough money and time, you could participate, but you're worried that you're going to lose your job, that's a big inhibitor on engagement. And in this culture right now, a lot of people are worried about their jobs. So there always traditionally was a structural idea about liberty, not just a legal idea. The only people in this country who have the structural basis of liberty but don't much use it are college professors with tenure. They can say any damn thing they want and they don't get fired. You can laugh about it, but it's a structural basis that it's a permitting condition for liberty for masses. With that, you can have a lot of free time. The society could permit great free time and sufficient security. That is a guaranteed job. That many liberals have called for guaranteed jobs, government jobs, last resort, so forth. Those two combinations, I think, are the conditions of real participation over time. So people have both time and security. But I certainly don't. Maybe other people have an idea about how much they would do. I think they do a lot more.
I have two or three questions on my own that I'm thinking about, but instead, I'd like to suggest something that happened that was very rich at a panel I was at recently where I live in Ithaca, New York, which is to ask the members of the panel to see, is there any difference between you that you kind of are seeing or needing to dialogue about that would be useful for us to hear about? In other words, if you were like in a room together and trying to really work it out right now, what is a strategic puzzle or question you might want to ask each other that would be illuminating?
I think one of the things that Occupy does is that, at least at this juncture, and I think it'll be in stages, and this is a moment that, hopefully is the right moment where it can turn into a social movement with everyone's participation and engagement. And this is what Laura's referring to in terms of action. But I think one of the things that, in thinking and hearing about what I just heard, I think co-ops are a big element of what the park introduced and what this movement is introducing. Mm-hmm. Our relationship to money is a big thing that we have to navigate, simultaneously retaining our independence in order to create a new culture and using co-ops to be sustained, sustaining our activities. So co-ops are a big culture that's emerging in terms of farms, printing, and the like. I also think that my question would be, in looking at Occupy theory and one of the second communique that's in there, it really is about reimagining the social contract, and this is something Judith Butler refers to as, there's a problem in social and political equality in this country, and I think it's a crisis of democracy. And I think that how we reimagine democracy as a mechanism for us to renegotiate our rights with one another or how we coexist in this space is up for grabs. And I think this ties into maybe the idea of the republic, but global capital and information, I would like those to be factored in and maybe highlighted in your thinking. It's not just the problems that we're dealing with in the United States. These are inextricably linked with external situations that are happening abroad. I do agree that we need to negotiate a vision, and I'm curious to see how, your thoughts, both of you on that, and Laura too. So it's something that we're thinking about in this movement because we want to, one other thing I'll say about, as we go into spring, reoccupation is on our minds, and right now they just occupied Zuccotti, and we'll see how much it lasts. There's this idea of it's not about space and a space for dissent alone, it's also about our relationship to time. Space and time are really what Occupy has put its finger on, and we need time to do what we're doing. So I would just like to factor that into some of what you said, but these three points that you highlighted, I love them, you know?
I just have a couple thoughts in response, and they're partly just coming to mind. Some of us graybeards over here lived through the 60s when there was a lot of action, you know, as much or more than Zuccotti and Occupy. And a lot of people got killed. And there was it was a real social movement for a while. And great things were achieved. The women's movement, civil rights movement, those the beginnings of the environmental movement, stopped the Vietnam War. And that movement failed. It fell apart. So it's a really, we don't have a good lesson from that. And there was a lot of craziness in parts of the movement at the end. Martin Luther King Jr., just before he was assassinated, and the march, remember, was the poverty march. It was with the janitors trying to work on poverty. It was quite clear. He said publicly many times and a lot in his staff meetings, we have to talk about democratic socialism, but I can't talk about it. So that somehow they couldn't get a different systemic vision on the table. I don't have an answer. I've said pretty much what I think. I think it's important to work on ideas and begin to debate, to flesh out the visions and come up with that kind of ideas, and let's debate it and begin to develop it. But I do think it's a heavy responsibility because there's a lot of blood on the floor that didn't work despite great starts. On the international side, I'm a hardliner. I don't think we're going to – I have a strange career. I worked in the House and Senate and even in the State Department at one point. I left all that long ago. But when in the State Department, you'd see some good program would come up to help the third world, unquote. That's how it was always phrased, help the third world. And people with really good intents, they really wanted to do something. And they'd actually get a program on the ground. And by the time it actually began operating, the corporations had turned it in a totally different direction. So I don't think we are going to be in position to do much at all really, until we become different people ourselves in a different society. Because otherwise the power structure is going to determine the outcomes. Maybe we can get off their back a little more. But until we become positive contributors to a different vision, I think we're going to have to change the system. Because the power structure is going to determine the outcomes. So what I mean by hardliner, I'm pretty much focused on what is Racine. I'm from Racine, Wisconsin, kind of a decaying industrial town. My focus is what's Racine look like as an element in the next system? I mean, how do we think that way? And then maybe we get, maybe pull back, get off their backs. But to be positive, we've got to know who we are first, I think.
I'd like to, first of all, respond to your question about the 20-hour week. I think you're right. We do need more leisure time to do political work. Unfortunately, that's not what we have, is it? We have to ask ourselves, why don't we have that? And what came to mind, there's actually a brilliant essay by an economist named Michael Kaletsky. I think it's called The Political Consequences of Full Employment, if I remember the correct title. And he says, well, I'll be a Keynesian for a while, and I assume we know how to create full employment in a capitalist society. Let's assume we can do that. What are the consequences of that? And he argues that if you have full employment in a capitalist economy, labor discipline will break down. And therefore, you'll have a democratic upsurge. And he frankly concludes, I think this essay was written in 1940, the only thing in a capitalist economy where you can have full employment is in fascism, where your democratic rights are taken away from you. A lot of the violence we have in our society is structural. Being unemployed, violence is done to you. To have your house foreclosed upon you and rendered homeless, violence is done to you. It's all perfectly legal, but it's all perfectly structural. I think that, as I tried to indicate in my own comments, I think that the various kind of cooperative movements, the various visions of creating the commons, should be encouraged. And we have to encourage it, and that's where you learn that how to empower yourself. You learn you can take charge of your own lives. The difficulty is that for most of us, that is not a realistic alternative right now. Most of us work for corporations of various sizes. And within those corporations, there's real coercion going on, the tyranny of your boss. And as I indicated earlier, it's nice to think we can subtract ourselves from our society and create these open places. But the difficulty is that there are people who are opposed to us doing that, and they won't let us do it. And this raises all sorts of very difficult and troubling questions, which I don't have the answer to, but I think we do have to the answer to them. I mean, like I said, you know, we've learned that we don't need the bosses, but the bosses still think they need us. And they're not going to let us go, and they're going to do, if their social economic power is threatened, they will respond accordingly with violence. And we have to come to terms with that. We can't be naive about that. I don't know, frankly, what the answer is, but I just know we have to come to terms with these questions if we're going to go forward. And if our movement develops and we grow and more powerful and strong, and we learn more of us learn that we don't need bosses, then what are we going to do? And frankly, we're going to have to come to kind of yes or term questions with this. And I don't know if I agree with this statement, but Zizek at one point says, with regard to subordinate people, he says that the question about violence is always maybe not legitimate, but maybe necessary. He says for subordinate people, violence, defensive violence, is always legitimate, but it may not be necessary. It's a tactical question. So I think, I mean, we're living in the United States where we live and we're relatively free, and we have our cameras where we can focus upon the police, and we can show their violence actions against us. But in my neighborhood in Brooklyn, I mean in Staten Island, violence is routinely done to the people who live in the black ghetto right next to me all the time. The police, basically, it's like Baghdad in certain times. And we ignore that, you know, and we live in a period of the mass incarceration of black people. And this is routine, banal violence. And you should know the stop and frisk activities in New York PD is perfectly legal. All those decisions have been honored by our Supreme Court. And we're going to have to come to terms with these kind of issues. Frankly, I don't know the answer to it. And I sometimes wonder if our simply the power of our oppressive apparatus is so powerful, maybe we're defenseless against this. On the other hand, if you talk to people who are involved in the various occupations, say in Egypt, where particularly the untouchables, whose job is to pick up the garbage, they've been violently attacked by the police and the army all the time, and they've learned they've had simply to defend themselves. So I think there are rifts in people up here.
You mentioned structural violence and started to get into that, and I'm really glad that you did, because structural violence is obviously all pervasive, but it doesn't affect everybody equally, which is something that you started with. And I think it's important that you brought up stop and frisk and race and class dynamics, because we know that those are overlapping oppressions, and we hadn't talked about that yet on this panel. And I don't bring that up to be divisive, but I do think it's worth saying that when we don't talk about it, I think we default to the white, the male, the hetero, the able. And so the question that I would bring to the group and the whole room, because I don't think anyone has an answer to this, is how do we confront that, the default, and bring more voices in and bring unique forms of structural violence to the table without necessarily resorting or regressing to 90s era identity politics that were divisive? And how do you create a narrative that is not all-encompassing, because it won't encompass everybody, and that would be oppressive, but one that many people can fall underneath, and one that many people can identify with? And I think part of it will be having the people who the narrative has always spoken of probably step back and learn to identify with a narrative that doesn't necessarily speak of their full experience. But that's just one quick major question, and then a small suggestion that I had. And then I wanted to...
Can you state that a little clearly again? You're saying a lot there, but I'm not sure it's that clear.
Sure. So I was having a long conversation with a friend of mine who was on another panel today about the movement being global, and particularly about its effects and interactions with Latin America. So he was focusing on the role of the immigrant and how the immigrant is the best symbol for this Occupy movement, because we have touched on it, but neoliberalism is a global injustice, right, that is devastated economies across the world and then brought people here where they face many other types of injustices. So we talked, and I was talking about narrative, which I wanted, everyone to feel that they participated in, but certainly was something of a not touching identity politics issue. So we were trying to figure out how our two speeches reconciled, and they didn't. So I guess my main question is, how do we start to work together to overcome our differences, because we have fractured ourselves, both in our causes and in our identities, but the culprits that have created this systemic injustice and this structural violence largely are consolidated in one and the same. For a very quick example, something like ExxonMobil, right, contributes to certainly the consolidation of wealth and the vast disparity in the resource allocation. Certainly the environmental destruction or destruction of our environment, certainly the issues with the conflict between developed countries and third world countries, and how corporations can go into different countries that are less developed and essentially set up structures that take all of the resources out of that country. So we probably could come up with 10 different ways to approach and attack ExxonMobil that we would find we couldn't reconcile it with. But ExxonMobil as one institution will continue to work sort of in solidarity with itself. So it's figuring out how to, my question to the whole room would be, how can we reconcile the various points of view and identities and voices we bring to the table in one that speaks really loudly and is able to challenge?
Thinking about the data that was compiled about the economy, if it was just distributed to everybody in America, it would be about $200,000. I'm wondering what that would mean for the rest of the world. It's a pretty rich country. It's only about 300 million people here, and 7 billion people around the planet. So just to throw that out there. Respectfully, my reading of the 60s is that there was one clear lesson that I was reminded of at Zuccotti. I saw in the early days when people were sort of writing on sort of cardboard and painting and stuff, it was great. One of the signs from one person in the viewpoint said, words are nothing, action is everything, which I think echoed a lot of the line from the 60s that, theorizing and sort of talk shops will only get you so far. We need to get out to the streets and really kind of like mix things up. And I think, the danger in that, I hope, is obvious to everybody in this room, especially when you talk about what is to be done, what could replace capitalism, and, not trying to reinvent the wheel. Co-ops are not new. Marx was polemicizing against Proudhon in, the late 19th century. If you're still producing for capital value, doesn't matter who owns it, if it's the workers or capitalists, Marx said, capitalist is just capital personified. I have no interest in determining, coming to Rip Wolf, it was like one of the more depressing days. My first sort of reality check at Occupy Wall Street was when he was down there, got a big audience and said, well, let me tell you about the Silicon Valley co-ops where they come together on the fifth day and decide what to do with the surplus. Yeah, you're gonna be either exploiting yourself and producing for the maximum and paying yourself the minimum, or you're not going to be in business for very long. Unless you break with the law of value and break capitalism, abolish the laws of value, you're still going to have the same contradictions. It's not a political question. It's, you know, it's an economic one. Politics is not in command on that level. And so I'm wondering, Gar, I'm sure you've read a lot more Marx than me, what do you have to say about his battles with Proudhon and, you know, co-ops? I think, look, the seed and the latent impulse, I wouldn't be here. It's a really nice day out if I didn't think that people, you know, wanted to and had it within them to, you know, whatever species being, work together. You know, I'd love to be with my friends and girlfriend. You guys are all lovely, but that's not what I'm here for. You know, like, I want to know what to do, what not to do. And what not to do is to say, if we could just make the choices and determine what to do with the surplus, that that's a new world. It's not, you have to stop. You know, the planet is sinking and we're running out of time. Thank you.
You want to start, Gar?
Okay. Rick and I are going to be debating this tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock. Okay, so let me, I mean, it's a really good question because and a really deep discussion. I mean, what I'm urging is a deep discussion of this kind of issue. And it's, so give me a couple minutes. First, Marx went back and forth on co-ops. If you look at the early period and if you look at the Communist Manifesto, he's pro and then he debates Proudhon. He goes back and forth during the crisis of the Paris Commune. You can find Marx also went back and forth on the question of evolution versus revolution. Several times he argued that the United States, Britain, and maybe the Netherlands would have an evolutionary path to fundamental change. So you got to read your Marx carefully, and everybody can pick a citation. But the question you raise is, it is absolutely right. I do not think that worker-owned co-ops are the answer. And for the kind of reason you're talking about, that is to say a... But I do think they introduce at a certain stage of development the idea of common ownership. So it opens up space to have a much more interesting conversation. And it is true, as you point out, that worker-owned co-ops tend to, they get caught in the market. And the market drives them into competitive behavior. Unless you handle that, they become competitive because they're on the defense. And some of them become greedy, looking for the surplus, but mainly because they're on the defense, they've got to expand and control and capitalist dynamics of marketplace dynamics. So unless that structure is handled, notice the conversation about Cleveland handles it with essentially a de facto planning system and a communitarian structure. The Cleveland model is complex. It is an attempt to integrate co-ops in a community structure, not free riding, and something of a market that is planned by nonprofits, not planned, but it's a dominant, it's a market plan using the purchasing power of hospitals and universities as a planning stabilizer. That's a very interesting model, and I think it's much more interesting than Mondragon, which is now, at those of you who like Mondragon, it's got a fantastic internal development, but it's at war now in the capitalist world market, and it is really hungry for markets. You're going to hear a lot about them because they're coming here for markets. They're in trouble because the Chinese and East Europeans are eating up their markets, and they're for the reasons Mike raised, they're having to face problems, even though it's a very interesting model, very important model. So I don't see co-ops as the answer. And if you know, all of you got a wonderful book, you've got to buy this book that he mentioned. There is a new section on the theory of just this question. How do you talk about the relationship between co-ops planning much larger collective structures and getting out from under the market? I think that's a very important debate. I don't know if this is the time for that debate. If it is, let's go at it. It's a critical question. I think co-ops introduce ideas of cooperation. They're very important, but I do not think they're the final answer, both because they don't handle scale, but also for the reasons he's raised.
I mean, I agree with your question. Actually, I agree with your point. And that's what I was trying to allude to elliptically when I say the capitalist won't let us achieve what we want to. As Marx puts it, the law of motions of capital are activated by competition. It's something about the nature of capital, individual capitalist competition, competing with another, which makes the law of value operative upon individual capitalist. And any economic unit within a capitalist society, given the capitalist structure, is going to be subject to the laws of motion of capital.
therefore the law of value, because it's forced to compete to survive. And therefore, I think, this is why I think there's really limits to, as I said, trying to kind of these kind of subtractive notions that you can kind of simply let ourselves out of society of which we're part, kind of way of pretending we're not part of the economy society which we're a part of. And I should note on this, one of the things about Marx's analysis of the commodity and the societies in which commodities are exchanged, and universal commodity exchange involves the buying and selling of labor power, is that no one is in charge of our economy. But quite literally, really, it's an abstract mechanisms which we're all part of. And therefore, in some sense, we do have to think ultimately of changing our economy totally.
You mean not even the 1%?
Yes, especially in the 1%. If there is inklings of their non-capitalist production that occur in our society, they probably occur in our homes, and mostly it's work done by women in our society. I think that's a non-capitalist act. One of the things I learned from this Making Worlds conference is that breastfeeding is a non-capitalist act, if you think about it. You know, surviving in our capitalist society is a non-capitalist act. But all of us, one another, are caught in this web of competition, and therefore this web of alienation.
I had a question about the cooperatives. Just anecdotally, in terms of the conversations I've been having, I sense that there's a renewed interest in co-ops, and they seem to be increasing. However, I think overall, in terms of the overall share of the economy, the co-ops are quite small. So at what point do you think in this country would the economic elites actually view this as a threat? And I'm brought back to the case of Argentina, where the workers did take over some factories. And there was some repression, but rather than repress, a lot of times the authorities would collaborate and absorb the cooperatives and their representatives into the government.
The answer is I don't know. But I do think, I mean, the way I think about it is as follows. This is a country that has almost no socialist past, long ago, so it doesn't understand, as an ordinary idea, unlike European countries where there's a Marxist tradition that's more culturally involved, the simple idea of how do you democratize capital becoming a central idea. How does that penetrate the ideology? It's important that pieces of that become common sense. Worker-owned companies, co-ops, land trusts. There's a lot of land trusts, too, which common ownership of land. I see these as fragments in building up the idea system. The idea system, for an answer, I think, as in Argentina, they've absorbed those worker-owned companies. On the other hand, there's a residue. Those of you looking at the takeovers, the take, that movie, some of you have seen, it looks very much like the structure in Cleveland. That is, the city of Buenos Aires, which is a state, public, now buys from many of these worker-owned co-ops in a way that stabilizes the market. They aren't as free-riding, most of them, in the free market. Those are elements, I think, in building up a coherent, larger vision. Whether they can become transformative becomes whether or not they become, there's a political campaign and a whole lot of other things have to happen, one of which is the idea system has to change. But without a whole politics that is not only resisting but transformative, none of this goes anywhere. We're in an early stage where the introduction of ideas and theories is step one in the idea system. And co-ops help open that up and aerate it. But I think whether or not that becomes taken over or repressed, that's the name of the game for the next 30 years, how we build an idea system and a transformative politics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Sure.
Just very, very quickly, I mean, on the notion of co-ops, just what Occupy has allowed space for people to do is to negotiate that on their own terms. So I'm not going to pretend to know. I'm just going to make a couple of observations that I think are unique to Occupy. We've had a conversation of a Q&A for about an hour, has been largely male, white dominated. So, you know, just putting that out there. I think it's important to recognize that we have dealt in society with abstractions.
That's what it happens. We talk about patriarchy, but we don't notice it. We talk about these things, but we're not conscious of it, and that's not a judgment on anyone. It is just to remind ourselves that we need to check ourselves. And we have notions that I think in Occupy in the park that was really helpful is stepping up and stepping back and recognizing the difference. And this is important just because part of what's necessary in empowering each other, right, and in building that culture that can allow for space to imagine possibilities. The other thing I'll make note of is that, you know, I mean, I'm studied in political philosophy, but what's important to me is not to get stuck in the traditional ways of analysis. I love Marx. He's great. But I don't know how much we have to go back in history to realize that shit's fucked up. Right? And how much should the discourse be, here are these meta narratives for us to then find a solution. And I think that's ultimately divisive, and I think that's what Occupy tries to bring. And it's this recognition of creating that space. You're right, it is about dialogue. But it's also about pulling each other up. And I know this sounds cheesy, but it's really the fundamental point that Occupy has touched on, and it's a cornerstone if we're going to give ourselves a chance.
Gotcha. I always lived by Putnam's book, still do, reference it all the time. Last year I heard him at Schoenberg. He talked about the great anomaly in those communities now where there's been more civic capacity, there's been more discrimination. And he talked about places in Utah discriminating against Vietnamese and other places. So while I always thought, oh, community engagement will lead to less discrimination, Chris and I come from Staten Island, you know that place, right? We have 8,000 Liberians in Park Hill that no one ever heard of, all right? Let's not assume that more civic capacity always brings progressive movement. What I wanted to say, though, goes back to, first of all, I want to thank you all. You're not only spot on, but I never heard the word so many times, I don't know. Yeah. These other panels act as if they're on Mount Olympus to us. And one of the ways, if I were to bring order, last year when the budget cuts came down, Chris helped us and other community people organize a town hall on Staten Island. We got almost 400 people in the mid-island of Staten Island to come to talk about where the money is in the city budget to prevent the closing of firehouses, school budgets being wrecked, etc. But I'm going to tell you up front, if I were to bring an average, ordinary person and say, Gene, where do you get these ideas from? And, oh, there's a conference. And they came here, and they heard agency, 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 discourse, 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 narrative, narrative. They wouldn't know what the hell is going on. We need a language. We can't let our language keep us from the very people and communities that we need to connect with. If this movement, or whatever you wish to call it, has any real traction among working people, that's my sincere belief.
Thank you, sir. Can we hear your question or comment?
I like your narrative.
You're opening up some space.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is just to say I love Occupy, and one of the reasons why I go to meetings and there's this one man who's very brusque and he doesn't like all the rules and this and that, but he goes. And he said, you know, he goes, I used to be in the 60s. Occupy University, but we had a university in the 60s. So I said to him, I said, well, what happened to your movement? He goes, I don't know, but it's different now because back then they wouldn't listen to me and then they'd run out of the room. Here, people stay and listen.
Sweet.
And I think that it's like, he said it, so, and he's talking, he's there, he's talking. So it's a different movement, it's a good quality to it. The important pieces are there. And I guess my question is this, does Occupy see the need, I see the need, there's vast areas of knowledge and our history that have been kept away from us in our education, in our media, in our consciousness. Does Occupy see the need to get that information that obviously has been kept from us because it would give us power to bring it back into our Congress.
I wish we could continue. I'm going to let this roll as I start to just make an announcement that we do need to be out of this room because it takes a while to set up. And I also want to thank everybody for incredible energy and attention. But before you go, let's thank our panelists. Let the conversation continue if you can in the hallway. Thank you all very much.